It's a popular stereotype that making art is a creative process that should never be tainted by the grubby world of money. But artists and musicians need to earn a living, so they need to find a way to negotiate the business end of things. Hi, Kirsty Melville here with you for Earshot, and welcome to the third episode in our series of wonderfully entertaining conversations about creativity between the award-winning painter Ben Quilty and RN's very own music show presenter and composer, Andrew Ford. Today, they're getting their hands dirty and talking about money.
I'm Ben Quilty. My neighbour in the misty green southern highlands of New South Wales is the composer, Andy Ford. When I visit him in his workroom, I'm always struck by how quiet it is.
Good morning, Andy.
How are you?
You like my suitably melodic knocking?
It was beautiful knocking, yeah.
Paradoxically, when Andy comes to my door, he has to bang pretty hard to be heard.
Good morning, sir.
Hello.
Come in.
Making paintings is often much noisier than making music.
Thanks, mate.
In my studio, even the roof creaks.
Hi, how are you?
We'll just stop these saws.
It's like a factory in here.
It is a little bit.
I couldn't help noticing the canvas in there, which in the middle of it, there were centrefolds from magazines that I didn't know that they actually made anymore.
You weren't meant to see that painting, Andy.
well,
as you can see in here, there's we work a lot with timber. We have to build crates, and we have the stretchers are filled with timber.
Say what a stretcher is.
A stretcher is the frame that actually supports the canvas that we staple the linen or polyester or canvas on, so that there's a surface, and they are like a drum when they're made, so that they're very stiff and the material bounces off it as I work. So we have timber supply, a big timber supply, a lot of wood coming in here, and Mira and Shari and Liam, who work in here, constantly using saws and cutting and building and making, and as well as that, making some quite large sculptural work that needs timber armature. But the supplier is in Sydney, and they consider that we are some form of timber workshop, and therefore there'd never be creative types, and particularly no women. So they send us every year a calendar of January is Amy, and February is Sandy, and I think it's hilarious. The girls who work here think it's even funnier, and they judge each month. And then I take the calendar, and this year took the calendar and tore the whole thing apart and rearranged it into that painting, which probably, hopefully, will never leave the studio.
Maybe not. I didn't realise that sort of thing still happened. It's tremendously old-fashioned.
It does. You just don't work in a great big factory that cuts up timber.
But so the people that you've mentioned, these are essentially your assistants. They're working for you. They're helping you with the business end, which is, in your case, very physical. We are surrounded by pieces of wood and boxes. And maybe we should talk about the business of making art, because I mean, for me, it's just horrible distraction, all of that, and I resent any time that I spend even proofreading, actually, which I have to do when a score comes from the typesetter. But of course, if you don't proofread, then there are mistakes, and then when the music gets to the performers, you know, then you start wasting time. And if you've got a symphony orchestra sitting there and the third oboe is saying, but I haven't got the right number of beats in this bar, you know, you can imagine. That's an awful...
I feel your pain, Andy.
So you do have to try to make...
I look through the mist and I wonder how you're going and whether you're still alive. Or the anxiety has overwhelmed you.
Well, that's what I'm doing. I'm checking the third oboe part to make sure that the bars add up. The notes are actually on the instrument in the first place. I would much rather be kind of making something up, actually composing. But I suspect in your case it's... I mean, because of the physicality of what you do, the physicality of making the stretches, for instance, is that part of it?
It was. I went to Sydney College of the Arts, which is in Balmain, fabulous old warehouse space. In 92, I started there. And great friends came out of there who are great artists now, Sean Gladwell and David Griggs, Tim Silver, Nell, some of the great contemporary artists from Sydney who most of them now living all over the world. But having come from I was working for a building and demolition company right through university, and for me to have the access to a brilliant big timber workshop was an exciting thing. And I learned very early on how to make my own stretchers with a hammer, glue, nails and a handsaw, and I made all my earliest stretches that way. It was a way of actually learning to really respect the materials and go through the process of also priming the canvas, actually creating the surface and the structure that held that surface. Saying that now, as you can see, some of the stretchers are twice as tall as I am and five times wider than a car. Big things that I don't have time to do. And Mira is an artist, Liam's an artist, and Shari's actually who manages all of the logistics and curatorial parts of my work. She is now also the first archivist of Indigenous material at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. So they're a fabulous bunch of people, and without them, I would spend all my time doing what their job is. Plus, as you can see, the box behind me here is would actually almost fit a car in it.
Mm.
That's for a sculpture that will head up to Hong Kong later this year. And just the actual physical logistics of getting these works from our island in the on the bottom of the south of Asia is actually a very tricky thing, and something that artists, visual artists, really have to deal with. You can just press click send and send an audio file, and I'm very jealous. But we actually have to send the object, and that's a big thing. And Australia, it's funnily, you know, they've allowed cane toads and camels, goats, cats, foxes and fire ants into the country, but they really are very reticent to watch crates filled with art leave. They make it quite tricky, and things need to be fumigated in the right way. And if, for example, they go to a show, in my work's going later this year to a show in Singapore, for them to come back from that country, they make it even harder.
Maybe we should talk about money a bit.
Mm.
I mean, what you do costs quite a lot of money, because certainly costs a great deal more than what I do, putting dots on pieces of paper. But in terms of the materials involved, you know, your work costs quite a lot.
It does, yes. The linen's imported from Belgium. The finger-jointed pine is all kiln-dried, the cedar as well. The paint is very, very expensive, pigment and oil. It does. It costs a huge amount of money. The crates cost a lot of money. Everything costs a lot of money, yes.
And do you work to commission much?
No,
so you never. So it's kind of speculative, isn't it? You're kind of hoping that someone's going to buy this thing.
If I think of it that way, which it does flood through my mind occasionally at 1 a.m, it's very stressful, actually. But
so have you ever had a commission?
Well, the War Memorial Commission to go to Afghanistan, that was a commission. But for an institution like that, with a very serious team of curators and staff running the art department, it's an open commission. Actually, in terms of that commission, was offered the entire collection of art, 100 Streetons from the Battle of the Somme, extraordinary work. And I, without even missing a beat, refused that opportunity because I really felt that I had to go to this thing with the knowledge that I had and go there with my understanding, my experience of it, and then tell the story as honestly as I could. So that was, in terms of a commission, as close as I come, really.
Hmm.
And it's different, I think. For a commission for an artist, it's inevitable. Every work that I make, I'm trying to reinvent myself or at least refresh my practice. And anyone asking me to make a work is asking because they have seen another one of my works, and it's inevitable that they will have some form of expectation. And expectation for me is very debilitating, so I just say no. How about you?
Well, nearly everything I do is commissioned.
That's right.
Because it takes a long time, and to write an orchestral piece could easily take 6 months. I mean, I've just done one, and it did take 6 months. I can't afford to work for 6 months and then hope that somebody will play the piece. I mean, in any case, there has to be some money coming in. So the piece is commissioned, but it doesn't usually come with strings attached. Usually you'll get an email or a phone call from an orchestra or a string quartet or a singer saying, would you do me a piece? Usually there's a date. They say, we want to do it in 2018. And sometimes there's a context. They might say, we want to do the piece as part of this festival, or we want to do it on a program with Wagner or whatever. And usually there is a sense of how long the piece should be. And that's one of the first things I always know about a piece of music. If I'm not told how long it's going to be, then I get a sense of the piece. I get a feeling for the piece. Because otherwise it would be like you trying to do a painting and you don't know how big it is, you know. So you wouldn't know where to make the first mark.
But in a sense, that's a very open brief.
And it's very open,
that much time, I think, is the other point to a commission, that if you are given time, then you can find your voice. And I would say overcome my own doubt about the expectation of the person who's asking you to do it, which is very important. Mm. So, I mean, I guess that's the difference. If I had every commission like that, as you just said, and they come from museums or the War Memorial or, you know, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, but the fact is in Australia that most institutions, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, for example, has $0 acquisition budget. They have $0 given to them. So every single dollar they use to acquire work comes from their own fundraising.
But what about, private individuals? Because this is happening more and more now in music. I find that a lot of what I write has been commissioned by a private individual who decides that they would like to commission a piece of music. I mean, I think this is actually, people have actually worked out recently that everybody knew you could buy a painting. But I think it's only in really recent years that it's occurred to people that they can also commission pieces of music. And this is happening more and more. And I've had some lovely commissions.
That's very exciting.
Somebody will contact me and say, look, it's going to be our 50th wedding anniversary and we'd like to commission a piece of music. Mm. Or it's my husband's birthday coming up and I'd like a piece of music and it's going to be a surprise. Or whatever. And I really like that.
That's extraordinary.
I like the challenge of that as well, because you can think, right, okay, so tell me something about your husband. You know, you can actually try to make something which is appropriate. And occasionally these private commissions, they do come with some strings. And I have to say, I've been responsible for the strings in a few cases, because I've said, well, all right, well, sort of what do you want?
Yes.
You know, give me an idea. And so the person says, well, I love the clarinet. Mm. Okay, well, so a clarinet piece, a solo clarinet piece, or do you want something that's, you know, I don't think I really want to write clarinet and piano. What about clarinet and string quartet? What about we do a clarinet quintet? Oh, yeah, that would be good. Do you have a favourite clarinetist? You know, well, actually, yes. Well, why don't we ring her up and see if she would like me to write the piece for her, and you can commission me to write the piece for her, and you know, and then the thing sort of takes off. And the example I'm giving you is a specific example, and it went further actually, because then there was the question of, actually, I wonder whether you could put some Estonian folk music into the piece because there was an Estonian family connection. And I said, I don't know any Estonian folk music, but why not? Have you got some? Yeah. We'll give you a CD. So I started listening and I heard this particular song, which I like very much, called Oma Kodu, which means my home, my own home.
Mio tul talost kulla savvo, höhas jo savvo.
Höppö höistä, mio tul talost kulla savvo, höhas jo savvo. Höppö höistä, lellot jo lellot, lellot lellot, rubas jo.
So I said, look, I like this song. Oh, that's good, because that's my favourite too. So the piece ended up, the piece that I wrote, it was a clarinet quintet called Oma Kodu. It was written for the Australia Ensemble, and it didn't just quote this tune, it actually, the tune took over, and everything in the piece is drawn out of this bit of Estonian folk music. And I had a great time writing it, and the piece has been performed, 10-20 times by quite a few different clarinet players now, so it's got a life of its own, and it started off as this kind of, would you consider writing a piece? Another aspect of the art business is that people say things about you, you know, people write things about you.
Mm.
Do you care?
I did care, absolutely. It was the second show I had in, which happened to be in Melbourne, I was 26, 27, and I got a very, very negative review in The Age, in the newspaper down there. And look, I've had funny stories. I made a painting of Captain S for the Archibald, and it was hung in the Archibald's a few years ago, the year that I returned from Afghanistan. And the young man who made that painting had been stuck. I asked him to find a pose. He lay behind a mud brick wall in Marga, which is a part of the Uruzgan Valley, and he was stuck there for 8 hours with another friend. They had to be out in the open so that his communication device worked and they could communicate for his team hidden in a behind mud brick walls. And halfway through the day, his friend was hit with an AK-47 round that entered his body below his testicles and travelled up through his body and didn't come out. And this young man then had to call in air support, and I had very long conversation with him about that, those moments that he said felt like they lasted for weeks. It was the longest day he'd had. Took him 3 hours to be able to land, to safely land air support to get this young man out. And the painting was in the Archibald, and as soon as the press got hold of it, one writer wrote a very sort of a thinly veiled attack and negative review. And I got a call that morning, and the young soldier said, have you read the paper? And I said, yes. And he said, do you know that man? And I said, not really. Why? And he said, do you want me to get him? And I suddenly realised in shock that I had a very heavily armed group of young men, some suffering the very horrendous effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, looking for meaning in their life and looking to defend the crazy artists that some of them...
Well, that's great. I mean, because every artist wants one of a friend like that.
Yeah. Well, I rang him straight back and said, no, you're joking, aren't you? You're joking. Please tell me. And he had a little chuckle. Look, it's funny for people like that, for people outside of the arts and outside of my studio, I guess, when they read something like that, I think some people would not understand how an artist can then make the next step and get over it. But you know, I spent a lot of time with Myuran Sukumaran, and you just got to get a first world problem if you really think that you're going to feel sad about someone being mean to you.
Exactly. I must say, I mean, I've written quite a lot of criticism in my time. I've never reviewed concerts, but recordings and books about music, I have certainly reviewed quite a lot. And the reason I have felt okay doing it is because I'm a composer, because I put my own creative arse on the line. But I don't know that I would have had the nerve to do it otherwise. Have you done that? Have you written about other people?
No, but I've thought about it, that's for sure. And look, again, this is not to infiltrate my work in any sense, because it is only my opinion. But in Australia, where I think the arts does come second to so many other things, and there is a lack of respect. In fact, there's even a fear of it. So I often wonder why someone working in the arts would write really critical things. Why not go and find something that they love and then write about it in terms of equating it to the great canon or to the history of that art form, and write constructively in a positive way about things that are good to help artists attract the audience that we often fight for against the football on Saturday mornings. Saying that, that's their thing, and if they can only write very negatively, then I don't care, to be quite honest with you personally. But one reviewer in Sydney, who I respect and I read, said to me that it is much harder to write a positive review than it is to write a negative review. And in that is the answer to why many reviews in Australia are so negative, and that's because it's literally lazy criticism.
Well, in my case, I suppose that's the impetus to write in the first place, because I like this piece of music, and so therefore I want you to like it. You know, there's an element of cultural imperialism in this, and I make no apology for that. You know, because I like it, everybody should like it. So that's the impetus. But this is also the thing that Auden said, which is you can't review a bad book without showing off.
Yeah.
And it's true, you know, because if you're going to say why something's bad, you're doing it from the point of view of somebody who is obviously capable of doing better, even if you really can't. But
there's a notion.
Have you ever learnt anything from a critic about your own work?
No. Look, there's one reviewer who was very critical of my work for not making things from life, for using photographs and using images from screens and even from my own drawings rather than having the subject in front of me. And I did at that point look back through my own work and consider what it would mean to go to the sort of extent of having to have the model there or make plein air work, for example. If it's about the landscape, be in the landscape. And I did. I actually made the effort to go and try those things. But
and did you feel the critic was right? Did you feel that the critic...
No, it's lazy criticism. It's ridiculous to say that in this day and age, in 2016, I can't have photographs in my studio. I use film. I was an editor. I still edit and make sure my own small things. I use photographs and digital images, and there's TVs. But saying that, it was constructive the way it was put, and I paid attention.
But now everyone's a critic on the internet. You know.
I mean, that's the other point about it. Yeah. Look, again, social media for me has been a vehicle to be patted on the back way too often. And I say to young artists all the time, don't put your work on social media until you have properly, seriously exhibited it in the atmosphere that you planned. And for an artist, that's visual artist, very important. You need to understand the space. The theatrics of the way the audience works in that space is very important to me, and it should be important to any artist. The context of how it's read. And I know young artists who just put one image after the other before they've even cleaned the paint off their apron. It's on social media, it's on Instagram or it's on Facebook. And I think one of the key parts of a visual language is that you see the language develop before you allow anyone else to read that language. Because if you're giving people every bite as you bite them off, you spit them at the person, there actually is no language You're just dribbling.
And have you ever felt, because people sometimes don't like what you've done, have you ever sort of stopped for a moment and thought, what's the point?
No, never. No. No way. No one's going to stop me doing what I do. You, Andy?
No. I think it's a bit like falling in love, you know. Sometimes you fall in love and you... Because you make this kind of gesture, this romantic gesture. And making a painting is that.
Yes.
You know, writing a piece of music is that. And sometimes you get rejected.
Sadly, for the world that doesn't like my work, I can't think of anything else to do either.
Well, is that... But having been rejected, you know, you think, well, I'm not going to fall in love again.
Yeah.
And then you do.
Yes. That's right. Absolutely.
Andrew Ford's composition Omokoru, performed there by the Goldner String Quartet with Paul Dean on clarinet. I hope you've been enjoying this series of conversations about art and music. I know I'm really loving the behind-the-scenes look at the way Andy and Ben work and getting a sense of the warmth of their friendship and the way they inspire each other. And I'd really love to know what you think. Is there anything about the way they work that's striking a chord with you? You can let us know by leaving a comment on our website or by finding us on Facebook. And if you've missed any episodes, I highly recommend catching up on them. You can do so via our website, the ABC Radio app, or iTunes. In the final episode, which is all about the grand traditions of art and music, how do you negotiate a path through and honour all that's come before you? And of course, when do you ignore it all in the name of creativity? This has been Earshot. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you next time.